Hey there, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Film Room Podcast, and I'm your host, Andy Proctor. As always, I'm here with my co-host, Dylan Olson. In this show, we break down the game of college football and give you a quick list and scouting report to give you everything you'll need to know each week as your favorite college football team buckles up their chin straps. Listen in and level up. The Film Room is your weekly game plan. Oh, that's a great sound. I am, this is Andy, the host of the show, along with Dylan, our co-host. I am taking a leaf out of the Utes book, and I'm cracking open a cold one, and by cold one, I mean a Dr. Pepper cream soda, and I'm just going to enjoy the rest of my year.
Nice.
Here we are going into week 13 of the college football season. Today we will be reviewing and doing some film review of unranked Utah versus number 17 Colorado, and at the time ranked number 6 BYU versus unranked Kansas. We'll also be going over later today this week's games for Colorado versus number 22 ranked Iowa State and BYU's game against number 21 ranked Arizona State. Dylan, my man, how you doing?
Pretty good, man. So I wrote this down earlier today, and I kind of wanted this as like, I guess my personal cold open for this is okay. A little bit of a pop culture reference. So in the original, it's definitely not the like original Spider-Man game, but in the Spider-Man PlayStation 4 game, so Spider-Man 1 that Insomniac did, if, I don't know, you'll know what I'm talking about if you know what I'm talking about. If not, okay. Okay, yeah. So in one of the DLCs, there are these, like, generic thugs for the Maggia crime family, because the DLC mainly focuses on the villain Hammerhead. Sorry, now I'm getting into, like, okay. Not a comic book podcast, my bad. But so during, while you're fighting
that's our other podcast.
Yeah. Well, while you're fighting the, like, the thugs, right, random thug, they just have, like, random fight dialogue, right? And it's like, right. You know, oh, what are you doing over here? Where'd he go? Or something like that, right? And in one of them, I can't quote it because he uses a swear, but in one of them he says, I'm in an A-kicking mood. And I'm like, I feel like that's what Colorado was on Saturday. And I feel like, although
yes,
it shouldn't have been that way with Kansas getting wins against two ranked opponents, and I think having a solid shot, like if I was Colorado, I'd be a little bit worried. But having a shot at a third, like
Colorado ranked, plays Kansas this week, right?
Yeah. And it's in Kansas. So, and Kansas is desperate. They have to win out if they want a bowl game, and they feel like they should make a bowl game. So,
they definitely should.
Anyway, I'm just like, both of those teams were in butt-kicking moods over the weekend.
Yeah, they definitely were.
So, anyway, that's what I was leading with. Sorry about that. Probably took too much time. But
that's all right. That's perfect. That's perfect. I wish that BYU and Utah had been in butt-kicking moods
I know.
Last weekend. Because for those of us that are fans of this podcast or fans of the teams that this podcast covers, we went 0-2 last weekend. The Utes dropped a really, really bad game against Colorado. They lost, 49-24. So the Utes offense actually was a little more productive this last weekend than they usually have been, but still just too little too late, allowing Colorado to score 49 points. And then the Cougs dropped a bad loss against really quite a good Kansas team, a better than, you know, 4-6 is not reflective of really who Kansas is as a program right now. But
they were predicted as like dark horse conference contenders at the beginning of the season, and they had a good year last year. I think they had 9 wins last year, which is, I mean, that's a good football team.
Yeah. Well, and we were talking earlier last week, and we've been talking since to make ourselves feel better about losing to him.
Yeah.
About the fact that, you know, I think that Kansas's year, has been really similar to BYU's year, just the fact that they've been on the losing side of all their close, you know, one-score games, whereas BYU, up until last Saturday, had been on the winning end of each of those close games. So you know, I think that Kansas, you know, at what are they, 4-6 now, they could very, very easily, I think only one of their games was lost by more than one score. They could very, very easily be exactly where BYU is right now at 9-1. So anyway, let's jump in real quick into the more specific details about Utah's loss to number 17, Colorado. I have to just say, gosh, the first thing that jumped out to me, besides Utah's poor play, was just how much of a vested interest Joel Klatt seemed to have in Colorado winning.
Yeah,
Did you watch the game?
Yeah, I didn't watch the whole thing. We were kind of, so my wife was at a funeral, so we did some driving around that day. So I managed to catch a good portion of the game, like definitely second and third quarters and part of the first quarter, I think, but we had to drive back home for the fourth quarter. So, but the thing is, I didn't watch it with volume, cause I was at my in-law's house and so I just, you know, kept it low. So I didn't hear any of the commentary.
A lot more tolerable. it was very much, and gosh, part of me doesn't know if maybe it's just that obviously the sports media outlets, they're just trying to find a good story. And obviously Utah's story is not a good story this year. And Colorado having, you know, a coach like Dion and having a player like Travis Hunter, who's in the running for the Heisman trophy, which we'll talk about later. It's just a good story, but it was just very obvious. They couldn't stop talking about Colorado. It's almost like they forgot Utah was even in the stadium. It was hard to watch, only from a football perspective, but just from a commentating perspective, it was hard for me to swallow a little bit. So the game started really, really well for Utah and very poorly for Colorado. Very first play of the game, Shador Sanders drops into coverage and throws an interception right to Lander Barton of Utah. Just what a way for the Utes to try to rebound, you know, very first play of the game, intercepting the ball, having the opportunity to go down and score and you know, flip the field or flip the game, really, you know, taking away that very first series from the Buffs. But they walked away at the end of that series, as they have with so many other offensive series this year, with just a field goal and not able to get it in actually in the end zone. And after the way the season has gone, the Utes absolutely had to have a touchdown there. And then the next series, as Colorado makes its way down the field, the Utes are able to hold them to a 3rd-and-23 in their own territory, and then allow an 18-yard reception to make it 4th-and-5, which didn't matter in the end because the Buffs then threw a 40-yard touchdown pass the next play. and that just kind of set the precedent for what was the rest of the game.
It was kind of a tough watch because with Utah's offense, you just don't have any confidence that they can come back at all. So if someone gets more than 7 points ahead, and it's like, oh man, this might get ugly.
Yeah. And the hard thing is Utah's of old, of years past, that wasn't that big of a deal. You know, you have plenty of confidence they could come back, and as long as they didn't get down more than two scores, they were usually okay. But this year, you're right, it's kind of tough.
Yeah. If you don't mind, I just want to throw out a couple of quick notes, and then I wanted to ask you one or two questions. And you can, you know, we can fly by the seat of our pants if we need to, because I know you probably have some other notes. But so the first thing I wanted, excuse me, I feel really bad for Isaac Wilson. You know, he comes in, he's not thinking he's going to play because of rising, right? And then it's like, hey, you're the starter. Right. And then he loses out to another quarterback in, you know, a time where it's like, oh, they're in a rough spot. And during the bye week, they're basically having an open QB competition, and he loses a spot. And then that quarterback gets hurt. And it's like, you know, the guy's confidence is probably just shattered. I mean, I've brought it up a ton of times. He's just he's a true freshman. He graduated high school six months ago.
He's just a kid.
Yeah.
He's just a kid.
And so I just feel for him, because it's like at that point you got to think, like, at what point do we got to preserve this kid's psyche, you know? And I like to think he's probably a tough kid. I mean, if you're a D1 athlete, you probably got at least some sort of mental toughness. But on that note,
yeah,
particularly the second interception, that is a freshman throw, man.
Yeah, yeah, he made a couple bad throws. And it's, you know, I think at a certain point, at least in regards to your quarterback play, I think the approach you have to take is just that you're investing in your future. I mean, it's nice to try to play for bowl eligibility and all that, and I don't know how much money or what other benefits come from becoming bowl eligible. I'm sure that Witt has certain clauses in his contract that probably give him benefits for, you know, being bowl eligible certain numbers of years in a row or a certain number of years total.
Yeah.
But at this point, when you have an expanded playoff, you know, if you're not one of the top 11 teams to get in, then it's really not worth it to be bowl eligible, I think. I mean, it's nice. It's a nice pat on the back. But at this point, it's like, you know, if Isaac is truly going to be your future, the season's already shot. You may as well use this season, the remainder of this season, as an opportunity to allow him to try to get more reps, get more comfortable. You know, every rep that he gets this year is another rep that he won't have to learn from next year. You're right. It's tough. He's a young kid. You know, I think he'll bounce back. He's cut from good cloth, you know, with his family. Obviously, his brother Zach is in the league right now. I think it's just, at this point, you know, I think Utah as a program, coaches, players, fans, we've kind of all just recognized this year for what it was like 2 or 3 weeks ago.
Yeah. So in a like short, you know, like 3 to 5 sentence paragraph, what happened to Utah's secondary? Because they just looked like they made some plays, but they looked like they were just getting shredded, and it looked like they had a lot of broken coverages and guys that were just wide open. And so I guess from your perspective as someone who played defensive back, excuse me.
Yeah. I'll tell you, so two of the early touchdowns that, and this kind of goes back to what you were saying with Utah, where if they can get up on people early, that's big for them right now. And if they get down early, it's a killer. You know, that I mentioned that like 4th and 5 that turned into a 40-yard touchdown. Shedeur Sanders didn't throw a terribly well-thrown ball. Actually, it was a ball that and I forget which defensive back it was. I think it was Elijah Davis, number 9. He could have gone up and got it. But it just was, to answer your question, it was just kind of bad fundamentals, bad technique. You know, when you are covering a guy in man coverage, there are a couple basic rules. You know, you try to always remain in contact with your man. It doesn't matter if the ball is, you know, coming right at you. If it's up in the air, it's a wounded duck, you think you're going to be able to go up and get it. If you are not in contact with your man, you don't know where he is unless your eyes are on him. You know, and so if you're running and you're looking at the ball, then you can't feel your man. You can't feel him, you know, with manual contact. The number one rule is get your hands back on him. Get back to him, because it doesn't matter where the ball is going. If the ball is going to stay short of that receiver, then great. Then it stays short of him and he doesn't catch it. But that touchdown and then the other touchdown that Colorado was able to score in that first quarter, both touchdowns were just examples of receivers that were able to break away from a defensive back who was not playing with good technique. You know, you have guys that are chasing ball, not covering the man. They're not high pointing the ball. You know, they're trying to, it's kind of the principle of like going to swat a ball as opposed to just sticking your hand up and just getting it in the space. You know, like, are you more likely to make contact with the ball if you keep your hand stationary kind of between the receiver's hands and then swat it away once you've got your hand on it? Or am I going to try to swat a ball as it's moving, right? Like, what do I have a higher likelihood of getting my hand onto? So it just was, it comes down to poor technique. And I don't know if at this point in the season, you know, if the coaching has started to slack as well. But
yeah, well, it seems,
that's the thing that I noticed.
It seems like when you're in a state of like extreme discouragement, like Utah's in right now, especially because, I mean, Utah hasn't had a losing season in over a decade, right? So It's like you got to think that in times of extreme frustration, the first thing that starts to slack is the fundamentals. And unfortunately, you'd hope it's not that way You know, it all starts with those little things. But that's, to me, that was kind of what I gathered, was there were a couple plays like where Dorian Singer had that first touchdown throw that Isaac had. It felt like he was like, well, I'm still here. I'm still ready to play, you know. But it just feels like they're kind of like, all right, let's get to the off season. And
yeah,
you like to see fight, but honestly, I don't totally blame them, man. It's hard to be invested in that when, I mean, especially for the seniors. The seniors are probably like, that was a bummer, you know. So I don't know, but that would be kind of my.
Well, I think as well, another thing that probably contributed, you did see some defensive dysfunction early, those first couple scores that they allowed, but then you actually saw, and this was one of the points I wanted to make, was Utah's defense seemed to hold Colorado fairly well through the middle two quarters of the game. You know, they would often bottle up Shedeur Sanders and the Buffs receivers.
They got to 24-16, or was it 27-16, 28-16?
I think they got it. The closest I think it was like 6-14 or something like that. They were within one score.
Oh, okay.
And then later on, yeah, they got it closer again when they were in the twenties and thirties. But they really held the Buffs. I think besides that, the first couple series of the first quarter, they really held them to like negative rushing yards and you know, not that many passing yards, but the offense was just so, we've used this term all season, anemic, that the defense was on the field for so long. They just, after a while, you start to break down. You can only stop the opposing offense so many times and then have to go back on the field with kind of that dead feeling inside when your offense, you know, your offensive teammates continue to struggle to produce. It's just really hard to go back on the field and want to produce and be able to consistently try to bail your team out of every game when you don't get any help from the other side of the ball.
Yeah. So that's
I think
tough.
It was just a little, you know, too little too late for the Utes. You know, they were only able to put up, I think it was 6 or 9 points in the first half, and then they got another 15 or so in the second half, but it just was, the defense is just tired.
Yeah. At this point. Yeah. They're on the field a lot. So, I don't think I had much else other than, I had no idea Warren Sapp was on the Colorado staff. He's like a senior,
right?
He's a senior analyst. I had no idea. And then the other note I had, go ahead.
I was kind of like subconsciously aware of that. Like when he hi Boston. Sorry, my dog's gonna come say hi. When they showed him on the sideline, I was like, dude, this is awesome. You used to love Warren Sapp back in his Buccaneers days.
Yeah, dude, that Super Bowl Buccaneers defense was, I loved so many players on that defense.
I think that was the first Super Bowl that you and I watched together, and it was also super memorable because of Janet Jackson
and Justin Timberlake. Yikes.
Yeah. Woof. Sorry, I cut you off. Were you going to say something else?
The other thing I was going to say is, what an interesting play, which I have traitor written next to Caleb Lawner whenever I write his name down. But but that play
for
where...
For those of you that don't know, Caleb Lawner used to play basketball for Brigham Young. And now he plays football.
So he played basketball for BYU, then he played basketball for Baylor, and then he went to play football for Utah. And I'm like, all right, what is this guy doing?
Yeah.
So he has a play where he basically runs to the end zone, turns around, and boxes out the DB as if he's getting a basketball rebound.
Like it's basketball.
And I was like, yeah, is that, awesome. I was like, is that legal? You know? And I mean, apparently it is, I guess there wasn't enough contact. And I'm like, this feels like the fourth down tush push that the Eagles did, you know, where I'm like, this feels like a loophole like a that you can anyway. So, either way, it's a well-designed play and good use of Lohner's skills. So,
yeah,
that was my other.
I do think it's interesting. I mean, he's obviously a very tall and talented individual. I wonder if he just doesn't have enough experience with route running for them to use him in any other situation. Because I think I saw this on an Instagram post. So if this is incorrect, then you know I should have considered my source. But I think he has 4 receptions for 4 touchdowns on the year, which is like pretty awesome.
That's crazy.
But it also says a lot as to how we use him. We basically get him. He always lines up to the left. And we're always in you know goal line situations. They throw it up to him and he goes and gets it, which is pretty awesome. But it'd be fun to see if we could use him in other spots on the field. You know, if he's that successful.
Well, he'll have an opportunity next year with Keithy. Keithy's done in college, right? He's got a.
I'm sure with his. They came out and said that he did his other ACL, would be my guess.
Oh, my word, dude. And, that poor kid.
And I think he will be done. I don't think anyone, just similar to Cam, I don't think anyone in the league is going to come close to touching that. So,
yeah.
That play, though, the Caleb Lohner play that you talked about, I would put in my coordinator's corner. Either that or the 2-point conversion shortly following that, the throwback pass to
Logan Fano, that was sweet, man.
Our left tackle.
That was awesome.
So I never realized that a lineman, you can pass to a lineman. They don't have to be an eligible receiver as long as the pass is backwards.
Oh, so he was like covered by a receiver.
I'm pretty sure he was covered because
interesting.
Unless the announcers got it wrong, I'm remembering what they had said that they said that he must have been, you know, on the end of the formation and he must have not been covered because he definitely was playing tackle and he shucked a block and then he turned around and got the pass and then it was a backwards pass and he scored the 2-point conversion, which I loved. So
yeah, good for him.
That was my other coordinator's corner for Utah.
So, good for him.
Real quick, as we're kind of wrapping up this discussion about Utah, Colorado, because we're already 22 minutes in, 23 minutes in, I just quickly want to further my rant because
let it
everyone
out.
Just
let
keeps
it
on talking, especially after this game, about how Travis Hunter, I mean, gosh, easily the forerunner for the Heisman Trophy. And I'm sorry, I just like he had some great plays in the game, but I just still don't get it.
If how do you say Boise's running back? Jante?
Ashton Jante.
Jante. Yeah. If he doesn't win it, I will actually be upset, and I am never one who's invested in the Heisman race. So
well, and I have to look up Ashton's stats. I know that he was on par to break, I think it was Barry Sanders' rushing record.
Okay.
For most rushing yards in the season. I think that's what it was. He was on par to break someone's rushing record for this year, which I think merits. You know, if you're one of the best running backs of all time to come through the NCAA, I think that merits a Heisman Trophy. And I think that for Travis Hunter, I mean, don't get me wrong, very impressive that he can play both ways at that level. But let's just talk about this for a second. He did secure another interception this week, which we'll talk about that in a second. He had a 5-yard touchdown run, and he had five receptions for 55 yards. But he had no receiving touchdowns this week. So, like, still a pretty good game, an interception, a touchdown, and you know, 60-ish yards of receiving. But that just, I mean, like, for me, I think, like, a Heisman-winning candidate should be having 1 to 2 touchdowns per game. They should be producing, if you're receiving, 100, 120 yards of receiving. If you're rushing, you're rushing for 150 yards of rushing. You know, if you're a defender, it's an interception that you actually created and not one that your teammate created for you, and you just happen to be in the right spot to catch a ball, you know. This game, he was the 4th most productive wide receiver on his team, the 3rd most productive rusher at a whopping 5 yards total, and he was ninth in tackles during the game. The interception, like I just said, was completely a result of the hard work of his teammate, who was in the coverage and made the right play and just went up and got the ball or swatted the ball, and he just happened to be the right place at the right time. And at this point, if we're talking about Travis Hunter's standings in regards to his offensive and defensive production, if people are saying, oh, he's this incredible two-way player. He plays both ways. He's so incredible. Let's talk about his contributions, okay? I get that he's not going to be number one receiver. He's not going to be, you know, the number one defensive back in the country. But he should at least be top 10 in each of those, right? As far as receiving yards compared to last week, he dropped from number 11 to number 14 in total yards receiving. He is tied for eighth in total receiving touchdowns. He averages 12.3 yards per catch, which is 13 yards less per catch than the highest yielding receiver, Tennessee's Dante Thornton Jr., who averages about 25 yards per catch. Defensively, he moved from 75th to 29th after he got his third interception of the year. So he's at best, you know, the 30th best defender as far as interceptions are concerned. He's tied for 23rd place in pass deflections with 8. There are 111 defenders in college football that have scored one or more touchdowns this year, and he isn't one of them. He's the 10th highest tackler on his own team, which is not great, but get this. In regards to solo tackles in the NCAA, he has 16, which puts him in 1,027th place. And as far as total tackles are concerned, that means tackles where he and another teammate combined for the tackle, he has 23 total tackles, which puts him in 1,425th place. So I was way off last week. I said he wasn't even top 600. He was not even top 1,000 or to even top 1,200 in tackles, total tackles. He is almost 1,500 players behind the leading tackler in the country. So explain to me how this dude, Dylan, like, help me understand. How is this dude anything other than just a pretty good player who happens to play both sides of the ball?
I'm going to say it's drafting Bronny James logic. It's a social media post. That's what it is.
It's a story. It's totally what it is. There's nothing about this dude that says Heisman besides the fact that he plays for a team which is coached by Deion Sanders and is now in a position to go to the playoff, which where, by the way, if they happen to beat BYU in the Pac or the Big 12 championship, if they go to the playoff, they are going to get handled, as will BYU, I'm assuming, by whichever team they get matched up against.
Yeah.
And Travis Hunter will have a minimal role in that game.
Yeah, it is impressive what he's doing, and I think that he should be like noticed for it, I guess. I'm like, if he makes the Heisman finalist, it's like, okay, that's cute. But if he wins, to me, it's like, it's us living in a day and age of like, hey, we did something different and cool and this, and like, it's not like genuine when you should be rewarding true excellence, which by the way, Ashton Janti, he's going to break 2,000 rushing yards. He's only 107 shy. He's got 3 games left, minimum.
Yeah,
you know.
I mean, he'll eclipse at least 2,200.
You want to know what his lowest amount of yards is in a game this year?
What's that?
127, and that was on 11 carries. That game.
Goodness.
So the dude's got 26 touchdowns. He's averaging 7.4 per carry over 10 games in a season, where he is getting at least 127 yards every single game. That is insane. And you want to know what else? You know, he has fumbled the ball once all season.
Yeah. And, you know, someone might come back and say, well, hey, you know, that's against the Mountain West, which is fair. I think that's a fair criticism. But look at what Utah did.
He scored 3 touchdowns against the number one team in the nation.
There you go.
And 192 right yards. Like, I get that they're in the Mountain West. Oregon. I get they're in the Mountain West, but they beat Washington State, who's ranked right now. They beat him 45-24, and he had four touchdowns against them.
Yeah, I totally agree.
So
I totally agree. I don't see how Travis Hunter is the forerunner in this conversation. Gosh, even Dylan Gabriel, who I haven't watched a lot of, but I haven't seen a lot of him either. Like, you've seen a lot of Travis Hunter because he's had some pretty spectacular plays, you know, just on ESPN or whatever. You've seen a lot of Ashton Jeanty because he's been so amazingly productive. I don't see a whole lot from Dylan Gabriel, but even then, like, the best, you know, the quarterback, the best player on the best team in the country right now, like, that person has to be more deserving of the Heisman nomination than a guy who is, you know, bottom 1,400 in tackles. I don't understand it.
Yeah, it's crazy. So, well, and I think has anyone ever had 2,000 yards in a college football season?
I don't know.
Because if not, no, I mean, if he breaks, that's the other thing. If he breaks Barry Sanders' record, which is, I think we were talking beforehand that that's the guy, but I'm like, that holds the record. But it's like, if he breaks the record, like, it doesn't matter who he played against. Nobody's ever done that before. So,
yeah, you know, it's wild.
It's like, apologies to.
Anyway, that's my rant.
Yeah, no worries. I was just going to say apologies to BYU fans. We're going to be pretty quick with both your review and preview this week just because Kansas, I think, came down to a couple of things that we'll talk about. And then ASU, we've talked about before, and I think it's a pretty, you know, pretty simple game plan. And let's see if we can get Kansas BYU done in like 4 minutes.
Let's review BYU Kansas pretty quick. A couple points for me. I think there were some pretty huge plays in this game. The 17-14 loss for BYU. Most of those big plays went Kansas's way. The first one that stands out in my mind is the quick kick, which resulted in a fumble and turnover to Kansas on the 3-yard line. I will say this: I didn't see the quick kick coming. But granted, I was also just kicking it, shooting the breeze with our BFF, John Webb, at his new apartment.
Okay.
And that's my job, is just to kick it and not have to pay attention too much, right? If my job is head football coach at BYU and I'm Kalani Sitake,
you got to be thinking about that.
I ask myself, why does Kansas take, you know, they have the fourth quarter just started, okay? We just came from a timeout where I just ran a couple plays, had time to confer with my team. I have 4th and 15, and I line up 4th and 15. And then before I snap the ball, I call a timeout, while I'm only down 3 points with the entire fourth quarter still to play. Why does someone call a timeout like that? They don't call a timeout to see what you're lined up in to try to convert a 4th and 15 when you're only down 3 points. They line up because they want to see how you're going to line up and how we can punt it on you. I mean, you've got to realize that something like that is coming. And I don't know if Kansas had used a quick kick at all in any of their other games this year. I don't know if that was on film. But it had to feel obvious that Kansas weren't about to go for it in that situation. You know, and to not have a punt returner, a fielder down backfield, you know, back in the backfield, to go field that and to have call a poison call just was a huge oversight for me.
Yeah, that one's so I think the main thing I want to highlight about this game is that BYU should be winning it. And I know I did say Kansas was a good team. We've talked about it. Right. BYU should still be winning that game, night game in Provo. You're number 6 in the country. You should still win the game. And so it just was frustrating with these decisions, like the quick kick. You can blame a little bit of it on luck, I guess, but I'm like, you shouldn't be in that position in the first place. You should be like, you shouldn't have screwed up in the red zone right before halftime, you know, like that. That's
right.
That's the biggest one for me. I feel like that, you know, you wasted a timeout. We can get into this. I'm not sure how good the play call was on that do or die fourth down at the end of the game. The end of the first half, you got 50 seconds and 2 timeouts, and you just ran it down their throats, and you're on like the 6-yard line. Why are you throwing a fade to one of the best corners in the country? I mean, even if he's not one of the best, he's one of the most experienced corners in the country with a quarterback who you know doesn't throw a very good fade ball. Retzlaff's good at a lot of things. The fade ball is not one of them. It's just, you know, I need to give you credit. You were the one who pointed this out. I was like, that was such a bad throw. And you were like, it was a worse call. And I was like, oh, yeah, you're absolutely right. It's a terrible call. Give your running back the ball and let him get it into the end zone. You know, you're safe. You have more downs and timeouts.
I think you hit the nail on the head. I mean, we had just gone. We'd taken like 3 or 4 minutes to drive down the field, and we had some good passes in the middle. We had some good kind of zone scheme passes where you had some receivers running in routes or stop routes or posts and things like that to pick apart their zone. But it also was built up by lots of good runs where we had run the ball down their throat, and we used the field well. We spread them out, and I mean, I don't know why we were hurrying so fast, because we had over a minute and we're, you know, it's like first and goal. And that's like the golden situation where you say, okay, well, hey, let's take as much. And they had all their timeouts.
Yeah.
Or at least they had two of them.
Yeah.
And it's like, hey, let's take some time. Let's try to punch it in a couple times, you know, keep the ball on the ground, keep it safe. And if it doesn't work out, then we'll kick a field goal.
And even then, for your like goal line play, like, let's pretend it's third and goal, you know? Like, there's still got to be a better play than that. You got trips on one side, and then the tight end out wide on that side. It's, like, it's pretty obvious what you're doing.
It's always interesting to me to see how often offensive coordinators opt for a goal line fade. If you have a Caleb Lohner who's, like, 6'5", 6'6", I get it. But when you look at it, you know, offensively, statistically speaking, and a goal line fade is a really low percentage play. It's safe, but that's also why the reason it's safe is because it's low percentage, right? You know, you're cutting off half of the space of the field that you can play in and let your guy go get the ball, which limits the amount of room the defense has to go get it. But it's a very low percentage throw. Very low percentage play, and I didn't get it.
Yeah, I just think. Sorry, did you have something else on the fade? Because I was going to move on to something else, but
no, go ahead.
So
go ahead.
I'm going to leave it on this note for me. And if you have something else you can share, that's totally cool as well. But so a lot of the things is I'm like, I would expect the coaches to just be better in the next game. I mean, you're coming off an emotional close win against a rival that, you know, people are arguing you should have lost and blah, 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 whatever. I would expect, and that's the other thing is the red zone offense has been amazing this year, you know? And so it's like, I don't want to just like pile on because I'm seeing like fire Roderick, it's a bad play. And I'm like, you know, and I know Roderick is a questionable hire because of how he was at Utah and stuff. But I'm like, let's hold on a second. We're 9-1, you know, like,
I think that, it's not so much about saying, oh, hey, this, you know, this is unacceptable and this is, you know, gosh, we need to change this. It's like, we just, you know, we've been doing really well with our red zone offense all year. It's just, that's where the fault came this game. That's why we lost.
Yeah. And I think, I think this was a decision thing, and if not, then it was kind of like, what do we do to change this? But one of my biggest issues is that when you come out first half, you should be up 17-10, or at the very least 13-10. You come out in the first half, and it's like, go get some points. And instead, it's tied 10-10, and you spend almost 11 minutes on one drive. And to me, that's just like, you can't do that. You're limiting. That was a third of BYU's time of possession, by the way. That is a third of your time of possession to try to get maximum 8 points. That's not efficient, right? And so I'm like,
right.
Didn't
mind it though.
If you're up 17-10, that makes more sense to me. I think you got to go score, but I guess maybe we agree to disagree on that.
Yeah.
But.
No, I get your point where it's like, you've got to go be productive. You've got to give yourself plenty of time to like have more, like if they hadn't taken that long on that drive, maybe they would have had more time at the end of the game. Right. Especially because that drive, I think it only ended in a field goal.
Yes, right? Which that's my other thing is I'm like, I am, even at 10-10, I'm more okay with the way you finish that drive if you get 7 points, but they didn't, so.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. But I mean, that's, gosh, if you could do that every drive that you had and it could result in 7 points, you'd win every game. Because you're, I mean, think about that. That's, you know, keeping the defense on the field for freaking 40 minutes of the 60-minute game. And that just is a great way to tire down a defense. And then eventually your drives won't last that long because the defense is so darn tired of being on the field. So
yeah, that's a good point.
I was very impressed, actually, with Kansas's defense that they were able to hold BYU to 11 minutes, 11 and a half minutes, I think, of total play time, which would have been like, gosh, 30 minutes of football. You know what I mean? So I think my last point is just that, you know, overall, not to take anything away from Kansas, because Kansas is a good team. They didn't play a particularly great game this game around, and neither did we, except for I thought on defense we played fairly well. You know, besides the first series of the game where Kansas pretty much marched on BYU and went 84 yards down the field to score their first score of the game, BYU's defense held Kansas to less than 160 yards of total offense.
In the second half?
And so I think after that first series. So,
oh, okay.
You know, that first series took them, what, three or four minutes to drive down the field, 84 yards to score? After that first series, Kansas only had 158 yards of offense.
So listen to this. I saw this.
Pretty phenomenal.
I saw this. Kansas's offense against BYU had a season low 242 yards, a season low 73 rushing yards, a season low tying 17 points, season low 13 first downs, season low 52 plays, season low 33% third down conversion. Yeah. For as good as BYU's defense is, that's tough to swallow. And BYU's defense is good. They all have 17 points. You'd think that the number six team, if you can hold a team to less than 20, you win, right? Well, so,
and I think that kind of just goes to show, like, what Aaron Roderick said today and or yesterday in the media coverage was, you know, gosh, there's not a whole lot to fix. You just have to get back to their normal ways. If BYU comes up even just a little bit shy of their usual 31 points average of offensive production, BYU wins that game pretty handily. If they score 28 or 21 or something like that, you know, which is shy of what they usually do, they win that game.
So,
it was
execution.
It was a good game for BYU's defense. It just was a better game for Kansas's defense, and a really unfortunate game for BYU's defense on one play, and then, you know, three series that just didn't quite work out the way you needed them to. You know, you had that long 11-minute drive to 10.5-minute drive in the third quarter that only resulted in a field goal. And then the Cougs were 2-for-4 scoring when in the red zone. And the two times they didn't score,
which is not like them,
first and goal.
Yeah.
Which is not like them, not at all. So,
yeah.
And those, obviously, those two times they had first and goal and didn't score was the interception right before half, and then the fourth and 11 conversion at the end of the game, which, by the way, you convert if you don't have a false start right before the play. So,
yeah. That was
tough loss to swallow for the Cougs. But I think they have the opportunity to bounce back, obviously, this coming week against a good ASU team that is now ranked in the top 25. They are now, according to the College Football Playoff folks, I believe, maybe this was the AP poll, they're ranked number 21st.
Yeah.
They're ranked 21st, number 21. I'll have to look up the CFP rankings.
Oh, they just came out tonight, so. Yeah. So before we get into that, I just want to say, and this is transitions into it. So the outlook for BYU, for me, is that that loss is killer and potentially kills vibes for the season, because ASU is good. And if BYU can't beat ASU, then ASU has a tiebreaker. So you may be needing Kansas to upset Colorado to stay in the Big 12 championship picture. And then maybe needing Kansas State to beat Iowa State, right? And so...
Or Utah to beat Iowa State.
Oh, Good point. That would be very poetic and funny, to be honest, if Utah were the ones to kind of help get the three-game parlay to get BYU to the conference championship. But I guess what I'm saying is BYU have overperformed big time, but I think it's appropriate to move the goalpost. Because it was like, oh, I get to a bowl, right? But I'm like, when you go 9-0, missing out on the conference championship game is a disappointment at that point. And I'll stand by that. And so going into the ASU game, I'm like, this is a really important game. And, you know, we've talked about this. If you don't mind, I'm just going to dive in. When I checked yesterday, Sun Devils were favored by 3.5. Sam Levitt is playing very well. The last three games, he has thrown 9 touchdowns and 0 interceptions.
So he only has 4 interceptions on the whole year.
Yeah. And he has, and that's 3 touchdowns in each of his last 3 games. And so he's got 1900, it's a little bit modest, 1900 yards on the season, but I think ASU have been on the rise and, they may have, I don't know if I want to say peaked, but like, they're up, they're doing well, right? And it's not just Scataboo anymore. It's like 2 more guys.
It's still a lot of Scataboo.
It is a lot of Scataboo. So I want to get it to that part next. Cam Scataboo, by the way, 5'11", 215 pounds. He's the running back you hear about. He's getting 22 carries a game plus about 3.5 receptions per game. He's got about 119 rush yards per game, 5.5 per carry, 11 rush touchdowns. He gets a lot of yards after the contact. We've talked about him. He's a workhorse. He's got a head twitch thingy that's kind of funny to watch. And he's a really interesting dude. And honestly, he's a pretty fun player to watch.
The most impressive part for him, I think, is also the amount of contribution he has to the air. He has almost, 450 yards of receiving and 2 touchdowns through the air.
So
he does a lot of that too.
That brings me to the point I wanted to talk about. So Jordan Tyson is their leading receiver, and he's got just under half of his receptions in the last 3 games on the season. So he's got 833 yards. So that's about 83 a game. He leads the team with 58 total receptions. You know who the next closest receiver is in receptions on the team?
Cam Scataboo.
It is Scataboo, and it's almost slightly more than half the amount of yards and just over half the receptions that Tyson has. Their next leading receiver after that is their tight end. And their next actual wideout receiver after that is Xavier Guillory with 14 receptions for 189 yards. So
my main man Dopinder.
Well, so to me, I'm like, this game is, if you can shut down 2 of Levitt, Scataboo, and Tyson, you got to think BYU is a well-balanced team.
Yeah.
You got to think that it's game over.
I totally agree.
You know? And
yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
I totally agree. I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, you're good.
I just think that
I just ranted for a bunch of time.
With BYU's defense, the way they've been playing, I mean, gosh, you see that. Even in a game where they got upset by Kansas, they, like you just said, I was shocked to hear all those stats you just said about limiting Kansas to basically their lows in every category offensively on the year. And, I think that in a lot of ways, Arizona State is similar to Kansas. They're able to kind of run and gun.
Yeah.
But I think that BYU will match up fairly well with them. I think their biggest threat with Arizona State will be the fact that Sam Levitt does have some wheels. You know, he is the team's second leading rusher at 348 yards of rushing on the year and 4 touchdowns.
Yeah.
That has been something that BYU has struggled with all year long. So I don't think they will struggle too much to bottle up Cam Scataboo. I mean, I think Cam he'll break some runs. I'm sure that will be the case. He may bruise him, you know, back and forth and have to grind it out, or maybe he'll break a couple of big ones. But I think overall, the BYU will be able to bottle him up. If all they have to do is cover up, you know, number 0, Jordan Tyson, and number 7, it's probably Kamen, Metayer. It's spelled Shimon, like Michael Jackson. Shimon. but I think Sam Levitt poses the biggest risk to BYU with his legs and his ability to create time and space. And, you know, BYU, I think they opt to try to stay in coverage when a quarterback scrambles, which then leaves a lot of room for him to run, which I think that's our biggest risk.
So if you got to pick two to cover of the three that you're just like, we are locking these two players down, which two are you picking?
Cam Scadabu and Jordan Tyson.
Interesting.
Because they're tight end. They're tight end, number seven, Metayer. He's big. He's 6'4", 255. He's a big dude, but he only has 228 yards receiving on the year, 9.5 yards per catch and 4 touchdowns, which I would much rather take over Jordan Tyson, who has almost 900 yards of receiving. And then obviously Cam Scadabu is their biggest offensive threat. Sam Levitt, like, if you're going to make him run, like, be my guest, you know, make him make some mistakes. I think he was a lot more mistake prone at the beginning of the year, but if he has no one to throw to, he's going to have to run a whole heck of a lot to make anything happen. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So yours is probably the smart answer. Between the three main players, I wonder if you just shut down Levitt and Tyson, you double Tyson and you spy Levitt and have a guy basically play man coverage on him. And just because Scadabu's not necessarily predictable in the way he runs, but he's predictable in the sense that he's going to get the ball a lot. And so you just kind of, I wonder that.
You could do that.
Plus he may still be injured because he was not super productive last game. So,
oh really?
Yeah. He was injured. I think he sat out the game before that. So
Well, come to think of it, I think I actually like your strategy better. Because if you can bottle up Sam Levitt and make him try to throw, and you can cover up their best receiving option, you make him more one-dimensional. And that's like kind of Kyle Whittingham's, you know, catchphrase, is trying to make the other team one-dimensional.
Well, he's got a lot of wins doing that, so.
Yeah, no, he does. And I think that obviously helps, because then if you take away Sam Levitt's arm and take away his legs and take away all his receiving options, then it becomes more obvious where they're going to go, which is right to Cam Scadabu. So well, and I think that's a good option.
At home, they run plays 65% of their play calls. So it's like
a little bit easier for sure.
Yeah. So I guess I don't know. So I'm going to get right into the game plan, just because the defensive personnel, the only guy I wrote down is Miles Rouser because his nickname's Ghost. But he's a defensive back also, and he's their leading tackler. So I'm like,
I don't know if you noticed this about him from his ESPN photo. He has his last name tattooed across the front of his neck in bold letters.
Really?
So it says Rouser right across his neck.
That's kind of cool. So there's some cool like Bowser art for him personally that he could do with that, I bet.
I'm sure there is.
But so I'm kind of skipping ASU's defense because I don't think there's a whole lot that's notable. And I'm jumping right into the game plan, and we can go back into it. But my game plan that I had written down originally was shut down Scadabu and Tyson, but I didn't even shut down two of the three. You're good. I think if you're plus two, maybe even just plus one in the turnover margin, that's good. Get a stop early, get a touchdown early, red zone. Both sides of the ball, because listen to this. ASU are 53% on field goals this year. Within 29 yards, they've kicked 4 times. That is it. Yeah, they have not kicked a field goal if they're within 20 yards of the end zone. So
they go for it.
Yeah, they go for it. So, or maybe it's 20 yards from the, I guess, 20-yard field goal, so not within 20 yards of the end zone. But they've kicked it 4 times if they're within a 30-yard or 29-yard field goal or less. So I'm like, if you keep them out of the red zone, you know, it stinks, because I think they get over the 50, they're in fourth down territory, which means that they're going to increase their chances to keep the drive alive. But if you can just keep them out of the red zone, they can't kick it. So are you going to do that a bunch of times? No, but if you can do that once or twice, you know, that's you know, anywhere from a 6 to 14 point swing where they're not getting any points, right? Where they could be getting at least 6. So, and then my other thing was, establish physical dominance both sides of the ball, but particularly on offense with the run game, because ASU's defense is kind of hot and cold. You know, I don't know. I think that they can be prone to getting taken care of on defense, especially if you're the one to set the tone. And BYU's physical; they can do that. So,
right.
Sorry, I know I've been.
I remember from our first film session about ASU. You know, before the Utah game, you know, famous last words, we were talking all about how undisciplined this defense was and how prone they were to ball fakes and play action fakes and counters and things like that, run pass options, things like that. And I think that to a certain extent, those weaknesses are probably still there. They've obviously reined it in because they're 8-2. They're not a bad defense or a great defense. You know, they've got guys like Miles Rouser. They've still got Shamari Simmons, who's a safety number 7. He's got 2 forced fumbles and 1 interception. He leads, doesn't quite lead the team, but he's top 3 or 4 on the team with 56 tackles. Number 2, Xavier Alford, has got 65 tackles on the year and 2 interceptions. Number 22, this is a new player, by the way. We didn't cover this guy the first time around. I think he's kind of made a name for himself this year. It's number 22, Caleb McCullough, who is 6'2", 225. He's got 59 tackles and 2 interceptions as a linebacker. So they've got some guys that like to tackle. They've got some guys that like to create turnovers for themselves. They're good about, you know, getting in the lane, or they're good about taking the ball away. So they've got a good defense. But I think for me, my main couple points in my game plan is I have got to have good, smart leadership, well-executed leadership, both from the coaching and coordinating perspective, okay? No more, spiking the ball on 1st and 10 when you have 1:10 left.
And 2 timeouts.
And 3 timeouts. It's like, oh, criminy. No more committing false starts against Utah when you've got, 15 seconds left. And you have no timeouts left because you've had to call a bunch of timeouts early in the half. You know,
that false start was bad against Kansas, by the way, because it had a 10-second. Not that BYU was gonna go win the game with 9 seconds left, but
right,
the timeout and the 4th down false start having a runoff was pretty pretty much a bummer. But anyway, sorry, keep going.
I would love to see Kalani make it to his last offensive series of both halves. I'd love to see him make it to those series with all 3 timeouts intact.
Yeah.
And not having to take timeouts because of, almost, delay of games or, occasionally you might have to use one if say the other side is going to do a 4th down conversion or that's super crucial or something like that. Occasionally you need timeouts or early in the half sometimes, and that's fine. But I want to see Kalani manage his time well. I want to see Aaron Roderick make smart decisions, consistent decisions. He does this a lot where he did this last year against Oklahoma. We're driving the entire field, running the ball down their throats. And we get to the end zone. And he decides to throw a screen or a spot pass out to the side, which gets intercepted for a pick 6.
Oh, dude, like, that pick was bad.
I would love to see A-Rod be consistent in his play calls, be smart in his play calls. Again, more smart leadership. I'd like to see Jake Retzlaff take care of the football. Okay. I think if Jake can continue, he was really bad at the beginning of the year. He's been a lot better the second half of the year. If he can take care of the football, keep the football out of harm's way, I think that really smart, good leadership is going to continue to put BYU in a good position like they have been all year. The running game is really solid. You know, the receiving game from Chase Roberts, Darius Lassiter, it's been awesome. If you can continue to get good production from Keelan Marion from a returning perspective, continue to give yourself good field position, kind of fight the field position battle, that would be incredible. But I think my number one thing for keys to the game, not even much of a game plan, is just good, smart leadership from coaches, coordinators, and quarterback.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting because I think ASU, I've kind of talked in a way like that. My tone of voice has kind of made it sound like I'm almost angry, like, oh, why isn't BYU favorite or something? I want to make it pretty clear that ASU is a good football team. The game plan is simple.
Well, they are.
The game plan is simple. The execution of that game plan is not. That's going to be hard work. Scottaboo's good. Tough. Jordan Dyson's good. Sam Levitt's a quarterback on the rise that's been playing really well lately against good teams. They kind of shut down the second half on offense against Kansas State, but, I mean, they dominated that game in the sense that, like, they took control of it quickly. I mean, this is a good team. It's going to be a big test for BYU. And, I mean, for me, this is so bad. For me, season's on the line. It's not really, but I'm like, you got to win this. Otherwise, you're on the outside looking in for that conference championship. And there's no reason you shouldn't be making that conference championship game with how the first nine games went.
I don't think you're wrong. I think this is totally, like, the season's totally on the line. You are right. Arizona State is a good team, but we're not going to let our friend Jake Kelso
pull another one over on us.
Keep that secret. Nope, we're not. I mean, they've had some good wins against Mississippi State, Texas Tech at the time, who was undefeated. I think they were vying for. Oh, excuse me. No, they lost to Texas Tech, but they had a close one to Texas Tech.
Yeah.
They beat Kansas. They beat Utah.
They beat Kansas State,
you know,
who I know they're.
They beat Kansas State.
Kansas State is not ranked and has three losses, but that is a good football team.
They're a good football team. They're another team who I think has definitely underperformed this year.
Yeah, they. Kansas State's got to be like, man, we really let that BYU one get away from us. And I'll be interested to see if maybe they can upset Kansas or Iowa State at the end of the season.
Yeah. So anyway, I am going to predict a very close game. I'm going to call it 28-21 for BYU.
I am not confident about this. My head is telling me ASU wins this one, but I can't not go with my team. So I am going to say BYU wins it 30-28.
Ooh, close one. I like
very close. So anyway, okay. Should we move on to the Cyclones?
This leads us into our last, game of the week, which will be Utah facing off against number 22 Iowa State at Rice-Eccles Stadium. And holla freaking Luya, it is a 5:30 kickoff. I have tickets to this game. I'm very excited to be home before 1 a.m.
That's cool.
Yes.
Keep an eye on it, because if BYU does beat ASU and it's like, okay, you're a lock for the Big 12 championship game, I think Iowa State is it's either Iowa State or Colorado at that point, right? And Iowa State, I think, would be a fun. Honestly, personally, I'd like to see BYU go beat Colorado in the Big 12 championship game, just because I think that's a fun matchup and it's a favorable matchup, I think, for BYU. I do too. But I do too. Iowa State would be a fun team to go play against, and they're kind of a classic Big 12 team. So, anyway,
yeah. Well, if Colorado loses to Kansas and BYU beats ASU, then Iowa State, they would be, they'd be tied.
Oh, sorry, BYU's a lock in that instance.
Oh, then yes, BYU would be a lock, but you'd have a two-way tie at 6-2 with Colorado and Iowa State, which I think I don't know if they've played this year. I don't know if they have a head-to-head. Looks like they have not played this year, so I don't know how that head-to-head matches up. Or how the tiebreaker works, but
I think they do something with like
a bit of a break,
common there. Opponents, and I don't know, something weird. Mm-hmm. But
whereas if BYU loses to ASU, if Colorado loses to Kansas, and Iowa State beats Utah, you'd have, Arizona State would have the tiebreaker over BYU, but then you'd have a three-way tie between
BYU, Colorado,
BYU,
Iowa State.
Yeah. To see who gets
I saw something that showed common opponents that they've played, and I think Iowa State has a leg up on BYU because of they either beat Kansas or they didn't play Kansas, but anyway.
Gotcha. So anyway, jumping into Iowa State, let's talk very quickly about some of their personnel. Just overall, they kind of tend to run kind of a run and gun type of offense. They do a lot of,
they're kind of fun to watch, man.
Gun and pistol formation. Yeah, it's really fun. It's like, it feels like old style football, but it's out of the gun. You know what I mean? They have lots of tight ends, lots of H-backs or fullbacks, multiple running backs. They do lots of pulling run plays where they have a pulling lineman or a pulling tight end or something like that, where they lots of powers, counters, sweeps, etc.
They do some funky RPOs out of it too.
They do some RPOs. They do a lot of motions into routes. Like they'll motion a receiver into an out route.
Yeah.
They'll motion a receiver, you know, that will then cut up field and go into a hitch or a seam or a corner or something like that. So a lot of movement, a lot of things to look out for, a lot of, kind of counter direction type movement in their offense. A lot of their passing routes are downhill routes. They don't like to stretch horizontally as much. From what I watched the film with them in Kansas, where they got beat by Kansas, lots of hitches, seams, corners, and posts. And that is led by their captain, number 3, Rocco Becht, who's 6'1".
What a name, dude. Sophomore. That is like,
right?
That's like a sick detective from an 80s crime show or something.
Yeah.
Sorry.
It's okay. It's a great name. He's 195 for 312. He's got 2,628 passing yards on the year, which is pretty productive. He's got 17 touchdowns, but he's also got 7 interceptions. So not a ton, but he definitely throws a couple. He throws about one every 3/4 of a game. He has some feet as well. He a lot like Sam Levitt. He has some good offensive production. But he can also run if needed.
Yeah. So I don't know about you, but for me, it's kind of interesting. I separated, rather than just like listing players, I kind of separated it into like the running back room and the receiver room, because this team really feels like a pretty well balanced. I mean, their receiver room is really two guys. I mean, no other receiver has over 100 yards. And that's Jalen Knoll and Jaden Higgins. And Jaden Higgins is really tall, by the way. He's 6'4". And they've both got,
he's number 9, by the way.
Yeah. So Jaden Higgins has got 860 yards, 7 touchdowns. And then Jalen Knoll's got 935 yards and 5 touchdowns. So that's kind of the bulk of their receiving.
Number 13.
Yeah, sorry. I should have led with the numbers.
That's okay.
And then the running back is kind of like a 3-pronged attack. You've got number 26, Carson Hansen. Number 24, Abu. I had a typo when I typed this. What was his last name?
I don't know. The only guy I have is Carson Hansen.
Oh, well, and then I wrote, it's Abu like Sama or something, the third, number 24. And then Jalen Jackson, number 12. And I did, so there's a lot of running back committee, but I was just going to focus on Carson Hansen. I just wanted to be aware of the other two running backs, but why don't you go ahead on Carson Hansen?
Yeah. So he's their leading rusher. He leads the rest of them. Well, actually he and Abu Sama the third,
that's what it is. Sama
shared about the same amount of volume. They've got, both of them have got about 500 yards of rushing each. They both average about 5 yards per carry. Although Carson Hansen seems to be the one that gets in the end zone more frequently. I wonder if he's the bigger of the two.
He is a big boy. He's 6'2", 220.
Oh, yeah. Whereas Abu Sama is, he's not small. He's 5'10", 210. So Chase Hansen. Carson Hansen has 9 touchdowns, whereas Abu Sama has 2.
I will say
you've also got this.
Hansen did not get as much production in the first 2 games. He only had 6 and 2 carries during those games. So he kind of broke out since the third game.
Proven himself.
Yeah. So sorry, go ahead.
And I was going to say then number 12, Jalen Jackson, he has got 341 yards of rushing. He also averages, well, he averages about 4.5 yards per carry. He's got a handful of touchdowns as well. So you're right. It is a little bit more of a running back by committee. They do seem to like to run quite a lot, but it just doesn't seem like they have any one running back that merits a lot of attention per se. I think it's just having more of an awareness of how to defend the run against these fellas while also not getting so caught up in getting downfield that you allow them to throw a lot of those downhill routes.
Yeah. It's they're kind of interesting because they have, like, I guess you've kind of talked about this, but they have a very physical run game, a very explosive pass game, and it's pretty close to a 50-50 split on calling those plays between pass and run. Mm-hmm. And it's really about consistency and efficiency. I did a little bit of reading about Coach Matt Campbell, and he likes to coach a strong team culture. He likes to foster player development, and he emphasizes accountability, hard work, discipline. And so the team is not necessarily like we've got, you know, a star player that is just like really elevating the team and everyone else is like pretty good or good enough to really help that guy shine. It really is truly like the sum of the parts. The sum is, what is it? The total is greater than the sum of the parts.
Yeah.
And so it's very interesting to me to see that they have a diverse run scheme. All of their running backs can make plays. So I don't want to get too lost in the stats. I probably will skip some of these, but I just wanted to say that Iowa State is like top 30 in a lot of offensive stats. And honestly, most of them are like top 20, including, you know, they're scoring over 30 points a game. They're sixth in the country in red zone scoring attempts per game. So they get in the red zone frequently. They're 17th in total offense. In terms of like EPA per play, they're 25th overall, on offense. And then they have a pretty good third down conversion. I don't know if maybe this was just me, but, tell me what you think of this. I feel like they ran a lot of like trips and bunch formations when they do split out.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I saw them being successful with some flood concepts and some RPOs. So, it was just, it is kind of a fun, it's almost like a modernized old school football offense. And so it's fun to watch for both people who want to see a little bit of flash, but also people that like, you know, that old school style,
like a more traditional. Yeah.
Style. So
for sure.
Anyway. Yeah.
I didn't do a ton of research as far as their defensive stats, but generally speaking, their defense lines up in a 3-3-5, which we've spoken about that, you know, earlier this year a couple times. I think Baylor utilized a little bit of that, where it requires that you have some bigger, stronger boys up front.
Baylor are looking pretty good now, by the way. Just as a little,
are they?
Yeah, I think they're.
I haven't seen
them. They're on the rise. Anyway, sorry.
That's okay.
You know.
So the 3-3-5, it requires a little bit more stout defensive linemen up front because you're giving up some space on your first line of defense.
Their nose tackle's 305 pounds, by the way. On that note.
That's a big boy.
Yeah.
It's a big boy. And then it requires some good toughness and speed and versatility out of your linebackers because you're expecting them to kind of fill both roles. You're expecting them to be able to get downhill and plug some holes in the event of a running play or to be able to help with the pass rush if it's required of them. And then you're also asking them to be able to drop into coverage and to be versatile in that way. So, you know, I'm sure, and I should preface this by saying, you know, Iowa State doesn't get to be ranked in the top 25 having a bad defense. That's not what I'm saying, but just watching the film against Kansas, I was able to spot a couple things that I think Utah will be able to take advantage of.
Kansas decimated them with the run, dude.
They did. They really did.
And you're about to lead on the linebackers, and I'm going to let you do that. But I will say the linebacker room has been the reason that their linebackers are, I guessing you're going to say, a weak point is because they've been decimated by injury, so they're filling in with a lot of young guys.
I actually didn't know that. I'm glad that you were able to look into that because I just looked at a couple of names and nothing really stood out. So I just figured they were kind of all
Yeah, I think they have two starting linebackers that are like, I'm not sure if they're seniors, but they're definitely like veterans on the team. Two of them that have been injured all season.
Gotcha. The guys that I saw at least against Kansas tended to have their eyes in the backfield quite a lot. They seem to be always kind of a step behind when it came to misdirection type plays, whether it was an RPO or a counter option type plays. Their first steps are always forward, which, and again, I'll have to kind of check in. Would be useful to get Gary Bowers on the phone here and talk about, you know, because as a defensive back, as a safety, I was always instructed my first steps were backwards because my first responsibility was pass coverage. And so maybe it's different for linebackers, but it seemed like in plays against Kansas, and I think Kansas had taken advantage of this, they must have seen this in the film, they would have some sort of play action or something like that, which would cause those linebackers to step forward for run support and then have to quickly retreat back into a zone. And they were usually late dropping to coverage or leaving themselves late covering a back out of the backfield or a tight end off of the line, which left them exposed. But that's helpful to know what you were saying about the
linebackers. Yeah, I think they're young. Well, it's interesting because Iowa State actually has an elite pass defense. They're second in the country in opponent completion percentage and fourth in the country in opponent pass yards per game. But you're right. They do have some tendencies to do things like that. And their run defense is bad. And I think they're 105th in the country in rush yards allowed per game. Right. A lot of that might be due to the Central Florida game, because I think they gave up a ton of yards in that. So that might be kind of offsetting their, like, median, so to speak, if you were to go with the median instead of an average. But fact is, I mean, I watched the Kansas highlights, and they were just decimating them, slicing and dicing with that run game. So they do have problems with their run defense. And part of that might come to the base three-man front and having five defensive backs on the field. I will say one thing. So that nose tackle, J.R. Singleton, number 58, he's that 305-pound guy. He's actually their leader in sacks with four, but I noticed he can get moved in the run game even on one-on-one. So even though he's a big guy, I don't know if it's a formation or a discipline thing, but he was susceptible to being moved. There is, yeah, like you were saying, Utah's game plan, I imagine, is going to have a lot of run in the offense, much to the chagrin of Utah fans who at this point are probably just looking for an exciting game.
Yeah. Well, at this point, I mean, I hate to say it, but Mekhi Bernard is like, I guess besides Dorian Singer, he's like one of your only veteran offensive weapons left. And I hate to say it, but Dorian Singer is not much of a weapon with Isaac at quarterback. So
yeah,
if that's the case, I'm assuming that's a lot of what we're going to see again this weekend. So
yeah, well, maybe they decide.
Hopefully it means that we score lots of points and the game goes by nice and fast, so I don't have to be outside in the cold.
Yeah, well, and another thing about that run game is the two leading tacklers for Iowa State are both DBs. I think they're both safeties. But number 17, Beau Freuler, and number 7, Malik Verdon. That said, though, they're both Verdon is 6'4", 220, and Freuler is 6'2", 220. Like, they're both big guys. So maybe that's why they feel pretty comfortable doing a 3-3-5. But when your DBs are your leading tacklers, I don't know what to think about that, because I feel like a lot of teams have had that this year that we've covered, and I'm like, is that normal, or are a lot of the teams we've covered bad at defending the run, you know? Because usually your linebackers are your leading tacklers.
And I guess it kind of shows our, like, relative inexperience and youth with stat analysis, because who knows, maybe if we were to analyze these types of statistics in the Pac-12 or the SEC, we might see something different. What it would maybe indicate to me is that probably a lot of defenses have coached their defensive backs well in coming up for run support.
Okay.
And I think defensive backs also get credited with a lot of like assists in tackles. You know, when you look at the tackle statistics, they've got solo tackles versus just tackles in general, which are tackles that were they assisted. They might have a half tackle here, a half tackle there.
Basically a team tackle.
Yeah, team tackle. So you've got lots of those, I'm assuming, going on. So, and you know, talking about those defensive backs, one weakness or tendency I noticed in the Kansas game was because they got beat deep a couple times, they tend to play a lot of zone, lots of cover two, and so those cornerbacks will kind of start to get a little bit lazy when it comes to receivers that are running deeper routes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because they're thinking, oh, hey, I'm just going to pass this guy off, even when they're on the backside and they really should be kind of one-on-one and kind of ISO with that receiver. With Kansas, at least, they started to get a little bit lazy and rely on that safety for that coverage over the top. And Kansas, I think, acknowledged that, and they got pretty smart by running a couple guys deep at the safety and giving the safety more than one option to have to choose between. And it left some openings for Kansas to go deep and cause some confusion on some long plays. So, and then when that happened, you know, we talked about the linebackers being more aggressive downfield. They lost that downfield aggressiveness, which then opened up, you know, the running lanes for Kansas to be able to move the ball.
So, you know, there's a word for aggressiveness.
What is that?
Aggression. Oh. Sorry, I'm just teasing you.
Yeah, that's true.
I've heard people say there's a podcast I listen to for Manchester United, and they say competency a lot, and I'm like, guys, it's just competence. So sorry, that's me being a total annoying grammar aggression person. But
you're right.
I just had to tease you. Sorry.
Hey, as someone who used to teach grammar for a living, I appreciate it. So I think that Utah, in a lot of ways, I mean, I think that they will want to take advantage of the run for sure. But I think that maybe, and I guess it's going to be hard with having Isaac at the helm, but if they could reverse their run first attitude and kind of take these defensive tendencies, take advantage of these defensive tendencies to, you know, be kind of last day's goal and kind of be committing to run first defense and opening up some lanes. If you can stretch them vertically and get them to back off, that will help create some room for you to run. So
almost do the opposite of the West Coast offense. Throw it to open up the run instead of running to open up the throw.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, obviously though, Iowa State is ranked in the top 25 for a reason. I don't think this will be an easy game. I unfortunately see Utah continuing to underperform. They will miss out on bowl eligibility by losing this game. I think it will be probably another kind of what we've seen. You know, Utah will be semi-productive on offense. Their defense will be quite good in the first quarter, maybe the second quarter, and then they'll probably break down a little bit. I'm expecting to see something like, you know, 35-17 for Iowa State.
I went 27-13 for Iowa State.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah, so, yeah, I could see Utah keeping it going early, in a sense of keeping it close early. You know, maybe it's 10-6 at halftime, but right. I just have a feeling that Iowa State looks like they have a really good 1-2 punch combo with their run and pass game that I think eventually will get the better of them. So,
yep. So at this point in the season, I forgot to cover this earlier, by the way, you and I are both 10-10 in regards to our end of season record predictions. Obviously, the season has not gone how we thought it would.
We're bowl eligible so far.
BYU being 9-1. Yeah, BYU is bowl eligible like we predicted.
Oh, no, I was saying we're bowl eligible because we're sitting at 500 right now.
Oh, yes.
I was just
as of right now, we are bowl eligible. Yeah, so anyway, that is where we stand. Anything else you want to add for this weekend?
No, go Utes, go Cougs. Yeah, really go Cougs. Please just go get this one.
Yes.
Just secure it.
We are hoping for the Cougs to be able to not quite secure, but further enhance and increase the likelihood that they will be playing in the Big 12 championship game to give themselves the opportunity to go to the first iteration of the 12-team college football playoff. the Utes will continue their bid to try to become bowl eligible in what has become a less and less enticing bowl series with the playoff happening. But nonetheless, we will root for our Cougs. We'll root for our Utes. As always, thanks for listening in. We hope this is helpful for you to kind of have a better idea as to what types of schemes you're going to see, understanding the game as a whole, and hopefully, you know, listening to this just a little bit, be a little more prepared as to what you might see and expect on the field on Friday and Saturday. Just on Saturday.
Yeah.
So, have a great week, everyone. Talk to you later.
Yep. Come on, Cougs. I want to preview the Cougars in that Big 12 championship game.